What's so bad about an Ivy League education? William Derisiewicz will join me to talk about his new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite.
This is about rearranging the chairs within the upper middle class. It's about competing with your neighbors in Westchester or Marin County or Silicon Valley to see whose kids get into the better schools.
What will your child want to read when not reading for school? Our new children's books editor, Maria Russo, will be here to talk about this week's back-to-school kids issue.
You know, there's a shocking ending. There's the usual social uncomfortableness and dynamics. There's a narrator with a really intimate, compelling voice that you get in a lot of these YA books that cross over.
Plus, we'll have an update on what's going on in the literary world and bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. William Derisiewicz joins me now. He is the author of a new book, Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and The Way to a Meaningful Life. William, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So that's a big, long title and subtitle. Let's start with the title. Who are the excellent sheep?
The excellent sheep are kids who go to places like Yale and the rest of the Ivy League and Stanford and other elite schools. And the phrase, I should say, came out of the mouth of one of my students in a seminar at Yale as this kind of dawning sense of self-recognition of herself and her peers. You know, the excellent part obviously refers to the fact that they've been very highly trained academically. They are actually extremely capable in narrowly academic terms, I think probably more than any other generation, just because they've been drilled from seventh grade or third grade or nursery school to be academic high achievers. You know, they can always get the A, they can always get the answer. The sheep part is precisely for the same reason. They have been turned into the consummate hoop jumpers in order to get into these schools, because the affluent communities that they tend to come from, and overwhelmingly they do come from affluent communities, are full of very ambitious, high-achieving, high-status parents who push their kids into this achievement machine. There are a lot of problems with that on the front end and the back end, but one of the most important for me as a professor is having seen that they don't know what to do themselves once the hoops disappear. Once they get to the end of the hoops, they don't know how to make decisions for themselves. That's one of the big reasons that so many of these kids go to Wall Street or consulting. It's not greed, or it's not just greed. It has to do with the fact that it continues to be the path of least resistance because it is a path that's been laid out for them.
Now, you know of what you speak because you yourself went to an Ivy League college, to Columbia, and then taught for many years at Yale.
Right.
Did your experience as a student, I don't know what year you graduated as an undergrad, but did it differ from what you then saw as a professor X many years later?
Right. Now, that's a really important question. I graduated at Columbia in 85. This is not a book, this is not an argument about kids today or millennials or how awful, you know, the new generation is or the last 10 or 15 years.
Aw.
It's the same system.
Right.
It was much less intense in the early 80s, but it was basically, look, it's the meritocracy, it's the SAT GPA system.
Right.
That was put in place in the 60s, basically. And it's just been getting worse and worse.
Wouldn't some argue that it's more equitable now or meritocratic insofar as it used to be that you didn't have to, you know, work so hard to jump through those hoops you described in high school? Because if your father was so-and-so and his father had gone to, you know, Yale or Princeton, then you were sort of assured of your place.
So there are a couple things to say. It is definitely more equitable than it was before the 60s. But it is much less equitable than it was in the 70s or 80s. It's becoming less and less equitable. I mean, there's statistics about this. There's an increasing socioeconomic stratification at selective colleges. And the main reason is that as the resume arms race keeps getting ratcheted up, it costs more and more. Your newspaper writes articles about this on a regular basis. How much it costs to do a summer program that a kid can write their essay about. How much it costs to hire a tutor. It costs a huge amount of money to create a kid who can get into one of these schools.
It's interesting that you bring up the financial question, because part of what I wonder is, about the economic causes of this on both ends. So on the front end, the fact that you have this increasing disparity between rich and poor, and those who have all of the resources can then, you know, flow them into their offspring and get them prepared to get into these schools. But I also wonder about it on the other side, when you talk about, you know, the fact that these kids are trying so hard to achieve in order to, quote unquote, succeed, whatever that means. How much of that is because the economy is just so insecure and jobs, you know, don't pay enough, that expenses have risen, that there's less job security? I mean, how much of this sort of is not their fault because the economy requires that kind of, right, you know, tough preparation for a cruel world?
This book ultimately grew out of an essay that I published 6 years ago. It actually was a couple of months before the financial collapse. So all of that stuff was already true. It was true in the Clinton 90s. It was true in the Reagan 80s. This is a long-term trend, and it has to do not so much with where the job market happens to be now, but with the way we've come to think about what's valuable to have in life. First of all, if you go to any selective school, it doesn't have to be the Ivy League, your chances of getting a job are very, very good. Unemployment is very low for that cohort. Second of all, for most kids, if you just look at lifetime earnings, there's been a very careful, extensive study about this. It doesn't matter where you go. If you're the kind of kid who could have gone or even who applied, but you end up going, say, to a public university, you end up making the same. Because what matters is who you are, not what school you go to. So to me, what this is really about, and granted that, you know, the last 6 years have inflected it to a certain extent, but what it's really about is not money, it's about status. This is about rearranging the chairs within the upper middle class. It's about competing with your neighbors in Westchester or Marin County or Silicon Valley to see whose kids get into the better schools.
One of the major benefits people talk about when they talk about an Ivy League education in terms of the job market is not so much the valuable skills that you may have learned in Econ 101, but it's about the networks that you form. You know, an alum of Dartmouth might look out for that alum of Dartmouth's resume that comes in through the door and might give it a little extra attention relative, you know, to someone coming from the University of Illinois. Don't you think that part of the anxiety around getting into the Ivy League is to sort of have access to those kind of networks?
Yes, I do. And I think partly, again, that's a matter of status, because what we're talking about status rather than wealth when we're talking about those things. But I do want to say this very clearly. You will be giving something up if you don't go to an Ivy League school. It is not without cost. You will be missing the opportunity to be injected at high velocity into the American elite in exactly the way that you just talked about. The question I'm trying to raise ultimately is, at what cost?
And what is the cost?
Well, I think the cost is the kind of soullessness that I've seen among elite students, that they have told me about, that sense of anxiety of being lost, of like, what is this really about? They spend their entire childhoods and young adulthoods in this race for credentials, not all of them by any means. But a lot of them end up saying, if not when they're 20, then when they're 40, what did I do this for? What is this really about? Maybe most importantly, the cost of being able to do work that you find truly meaningful.
One of the things that I wonder, like, how much can you generalize about these schools collectively, even, you know, not just the Ivy League, but, you know, let's include Stanford in it, the quote unquote little Ivies of Amherst, Williams and Wesleyan, because at least, you know, when I was going to college, each of these had a very distinct reputation, some of them as being the kind of thing that you're talking about. You know, people thought, well, Princeton is like that,
right.
You know, for better or for worse, or, you know, they might be true or less true. And then other schools were considered, you know, oh, well, people who go to Wesleyan aren't like that. People who go to Williams are true intellectuals. Do you think it's become more pervasive?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I do champion the liberal arts colleges in the book, and I do think that they're different places to a certain extent. Also, obviously, each school has its own unique character, et cetera, that should go without saying. Sometimes we're just talking about the narcissism of small differences, right? I mean, what difference really is there between Harvard, Yale, and Princeton? In the larger scheme of things, they're all basically the same institutions. Really, to me, the issue is that all the kids who get to these schools are going through the same sort of high school process, right?
Right.
The same, who do I have to become to get into one of these schools process, even before they think about where they're going. So, right, that's really the issue. It's not so much the colleges, but what the admissions process, what kind of person it creates. And then the other thing is, you know, from my reading about higher education, there does seem to be an ongoing homogenization. Not entirely. Schools still retain a lot of their own character, but the best example, I think, is the University of Chicago, which is always this byword for intellectualism. And as you may know, in recent years, they decided to change the way they market themselves, basically, and to become more like what the schools they wanted to be their peers. And they met, and, you know, it succeeded. They dropped their admissions, their admit rate way down. They moved up significantly in the rankings. But I'm afraid that they're going to cease to be the University of Chicago.
It was easier to get in there because fewer people wanted to go because it was so darn hard once you got there.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Conversely, the reputation for places like Harvard or Brown was that the hardest thing was getting in, and that once you got there, you sort of could relax for 4 years after having put yourself through hell in high school.
I mean, that is yet another problem.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't think kids, in general, they don't relax. I mean, they may relax on their studies, right? But they're still going at warp speed. I mean, there was an article in the Harvard Alumni Magazine just profiling. It wasn't even critical like mine. It was just profiling, like, this constant nonstop, you know, roommates passing like ships in the night as they run from one activity to another. But first of all, look, I mean, you've been formed as a certain kind of person by the time you get to college. I mean, there's quite a bit of room for change after that. But to say, well, you can relax once you get there, okay, but you've still done that whole hoop jumping thing. And then second of all, I actually think colleges should push against their students academically. They should challenge them to really be thoughtful, curious, intellectual people and not just sort of pass them through as certifying institutions to the next elite stage, you know, medical school or Goldman Sachs or whatever. So to say that you can relax at a place like Harvard and Brown is not to me a recommendation.
Right. So to say that you think that the colleges should teach students how to think as opposed to how to succeed.
That's a great way of putting it. I wish I put it myself that way.
There you go, your next subtitle. Is the problem the institutions of the universities? Is it the professors and the way that they teach or their own ambitions and how those are defined? Is it the students? Is it the parents? I mean, sort of, or is it all of them in different ways?
Unfortunately, it's all of them in different ways, which is why my book deals with all of them and has to be as wide-ranging as it is. I, at the risk of being diffuse, I felt that the only way to talk about these things is to talk about them as a system. And because, you know, we have books about overstressed high school kids. We have books about failing universities or professors who don't teach. The point is these things are all connected. And that's also what makes it so hard to kind of break into the system, because everybody is following sort of the logic of their own incentives. Which is why, I should say, and I want to make this clear, because I don't think the coverage of the book has really talked about this. Half of the book is a positive, constructive, you know, how you can save yourself from the system if you're a young person or the parent of a young person. So it's not just criticism. But the reason that my main, you know, the overwhelming majority of my what we can do about it is what you as an individual can do about it, because the system is going to be very hard to change if we can ever change it.
What do you think should be changed?
We can start by changing the admissions process, because that's the fulcrum on which everything turns. And back in the 60s, when they made the shift, and it was a very conscious shift, very courageous shift, from the aristocracy old boy network to the meritocracy, it started with admissions criteria, and really a radical changes in admissions criteria. I'm not enough of an expert in this to be able to say do X, Y, and Z, but I can say what the principles should be, which is we need, instead of to select for conformity and kind of contentless ambition, for risk-taking. Because now if you're admitted by GPA, you have no incentive to take a class you might not do well in or to try it, to fail, right? I mean, kids are terrified of failing. So risk-taking, independent-mindedness, resilience. I talk about, look, a limit on the number of extracurriculars you can put on your resume, and so on and so forth. But the other big thing that happened after the war, as the elite institutions started to open themselves up, is we built, through public money, these great systems of public higher education, like most obviously the University of California. And to me, that's ultimately the real answer. And I know it would take a great deal of political will and a great deal of financial capital to resurrect our great public higher education so that you don't have to go to Harvard or Yale.
And that's running very much against the economic trend right now.
It's very much against the economic trends. But, you know, I feel like since Occupy, we've really started to think about inequality. And people are now talking. I mean, there's a real movement now about the minimum wage. And to me, the next battle should be about free, high-quality public higher education.
To what extent does race and affirmative action, and not only based on race and ethnicity, but also on economic status, factor into the problem or the solution?
Well, you know, I don't talk about race and affirmative action really at all in the book, because I want to focus our attention elsewhere. I mean, that's obviously an ongoing issue.
Well, the reason I ask is because when we talk about like the benefits of an Ivy League education or an elite college education, one of the traditional arguments in favor of affirmative action or to allow kids who have had less economic opportunity to have access is those networks, is to, you know, be a true meritocracy. Do you see that as a benefit of these schools, or is that, or should that not be a goal?
Right. That is definitely a benefit of these schools. But it's important to recognize a couple of things. At this point, many of the students of color who get to Ivy League schools already come from affluent families, and in many cases, they come from families from overseas, either directly or first generation. Second of all, the number of actual poor kids at these schools is very small, on the order of 3 or 4%. And even from the entire bottom half or three-fifths of the income distribution, it's like 15 or 20%. So to a great extent, I think this is our alibi. This is like on the order of Barack Obama made it, so of course everything's fine because one person made it.
Right.
You have a few hundred or a few thousand kids who can get to the Ivy League, and you have hundreds of thousands of kids who are now shut out of a good college education because of what we've done to public higher education. If you want to help poor communities and communities of color, that's what you need to do.
Last question that I'll ask you, because it's one of those questions that's on so many students and parents of students' minds, is, you know, you talk about ways to reform the admissions process and about the importance of risk taking. I wonder, though, it seems that at least historically, when anything sort of became the new thing, the new risk taking, you know, so many other people glommed on that it just became part of what everyone does to get into college. Just as an example, I remember there was a period where everyone thought, okay, they need well-rounded students. So everyone was doing, you know, 15 different extracurriculars of different types. Then they said, no. What Ivy Leagues want is a well-rounded student body. What you need to do is excel in, you know, two or three weird things. So you need to play the viola and juggle and, you know, and so then everybody did that. And then they said, well, the risk, you know, the next risk taking would be you need to go to Honduras and build a dam. And, you know, then everybody went and did that. So it seems like a very hard thing to reform.
I totally agree with you. You know, or the college essay, right? This is how the kid is going to show their individuality. Well, you know, now the essays are all ghostwritten by, you know, coaches, right?
Famous authors.
There's no criterion that the upper middle class could not figure out a way of gaming or engineering. Maybe some are harder than others. But again, all I can say is that's why we need to do away with this. I mean, how did we end up with a system where we've outsourced the creation of our leadership class, of our economic elite, to a small set of private institutions? I mean, there are historical reasons for it, but it makes no sense. We've created essentially an artificial scarcity of educational resources. I don't think anything will fundamentally change until we make the commitment to public higher ed, but we did it once. We did it. We could do it again if we wanted to.
A big call to action from William Derisiewicz. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Derisiewicz is the author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life, reviewed this week in the Book Review. Alexandra Alter joins me now to talk about what's going on in the book world this week. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So you wrote a story recently about crowdfunded novels, crowdsourced novels. What What is this?
So this is something that publishers and authors have been looking at recently as not only a way to for authors to raise money to write the books, but to really get readers invested in the books before they're even written, before they're even published, to get an audience built there. You know, the publisher Macmillan has started this new imprint. It's a YA romance imprint called Swoon Reads. Their first novel comes out next week. It's by Sandy Hall. She's a teen librarian. And the way they choose the novels is they get writers to post them on a website. There's 10,000 registered users on the site, and they read them, and they comment, and they vote. They give it a certain number of hearts, and the one that gets the most hearts, or the ones that get the most hearts, get looked at by editors, and they've picked six books that way.
Those two genres, romance and YA, seem kind of tailored to this type of experiment.
Absolutely. I mean, there are two things that the publisher was looking at that they felt like they wanted to tap into. One was kind of the reality show movement and talent shows, and they wanted something like that in publishing that would get fans excited.
America's Got Romance.
Exactly. America's Next Top Novelist. But they also were looking at self-publishing and, you know, what's a way to get those manuscripts not only in front of us but in front of fans and to see what's doing well. I mean, publishers have already been looking at sites like Wattpad, which is a website where a lot of young writers post their stuff for free, and it's getting, you know, millions of clicks is how it's measured. So you can really take something that already has a following and, you know, publish it. The question is whether people will pay for a print copy of something that, you know, they will read online for free. And, you know, that's a real question. We'll see next week when the book comes out.
Is it coming out in print format or is it an ebook only?
It's a print book, yeah. They're releasing it. And they're actually, the announced first printing is pretty large. It's 100,000 copies, which for an unknown debut author is massive. So, and it's also coming out overseas in the UK and Germany and Australia. So,
inspiring librarians everywhere.
Exactly. And then, you know, beyond that, there are a number of authors who are using sites like Kickstarter. I think they, you know, something like $22 million were raised for books last year on Kickstarter. You know, and there's a number of companies that are now helping authors go directly to readers to get basically cobbled together in advance if they can't get a deal. And one of the authors who tried this recently was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. His name is Paul Kingsnorth. He's an English writer. And he published his first, I'm not sure if it was first, but he published his novel with Unbound, this new company. Mm-hmm. And it's longlisted. So that's a first as well.
Wow. The interesting thing is that there's crowdfunding and then there's crowdsourcing, and then they can kind of blur that, in that a lot of authors are kind of using social media and other forums to create a built-in readership, but also to kind of shape content.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's something that Aziz Ansari did recently. He's working on a book about modern dating rituals, and he went on Reddit and just posted a bunch of questions and asked people what they would want to see in the book, what kind of topics he should cover, if they had any experiences that could, you know, give him ideas. And that's, you know, people are using sites like that. Walter Isaacson used the site Medium to post an early chapter of his upcoming book, The Innovators, and he was really looking for feedback, for suggestions, for corrections if he'd gotten something wrong. So it's not only a way to get an audience, but a way to figure out what your book, you know, what it's going to look like, what the content's going to be.
All right. Well, shape your next favorite author's novel, I guess. Thanks,
yeah,
Alexandra.
Exactly. Thanks for having me.
I am happy to introduce to listeners our new children's books editor, Maria Russo.
Hi, Pamela.
So you are new to the book review, but not entirely, because you've been here before. Was it 10 years ago that you worked at the book review?
It was 2001, actually. I was here in 9/11, 2001.
And what have you been doing since?
And then I worked at the New York Observer for a couple of years, and I moved out to Los Angeles to work at the Los Angeles Times in the calendar section, which is their culture and entertainment section. And I was there for 4 years. And then I have been freelancing and writing. And for the last year, I edited a little magazine called Pasadena Magazine, a long way from Manhattan. And now here I am.
But along during that whole freelance period, you were a contributor very frequently to our
pages.
The book
review.
Yes.
Yes.
You reviewed most recently The Snow Queen by Michael Cunningham. And then notably in terms of children's books, reviewed R.J. Palacio's Wonder.
I see it now as a portent of things to come because I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. And I was really amazed by what you can do. This is a middle grade novel with so much sophistication and heart and just a really a book that I thought about a lot after, and my daughter, who was 9 at the time, read and passed it to all her friends. And the book is still selling, and people are still reading it and talking about it. There's a movie coming out, so I felt thrilled and honored that I was able to review that book. I'd never heard of, you know, her. It was her first novel, so.
Now, you mentioned your daughter. You are the third parent of three in a row to hold this job. But you, I think, have a kind of unique position because your children are all in sort of different reader age categories.
Yes. It's a little strenuous right now at our house book-wise because we have a picture book reader, a 4-year-old, a middle grades 8-year-old who likes early chapter books and a lot of the graphic novels that are really big with that age group. And my 11-and-a-half-year-old, she's full-on YA. She's a precocious reader. I mean, she does do some of the older middle-grade novels still, but she's a really big she loves fantasy and a lot of the series, the Divergent series, and obviously Hunger Games, and Harry Potter, of course, which...
So co-editors in the household. Let's talk a little bit about the issue this week. This is our third annual Back to School issue, where we include a larger number of children's reviews than usual, all tied into the return to the classroom, but not in the kind of ABC 1-2-3 way, more in the, you know, social and emotional, how do I get ready, really ready for school? What trends are you seeing in the books that we're covering?
Well, this section is interesting because we really, I think, see a full range of what's out there now that is making such a stir with readers of all ages. The two books that jumped out at me are both graphic memoirs, which is an interesting genre, Sisters by Raina Telgemeier and El Defo by Cece Bell. And we actually had some debate at the book review about what to call them because the publishers are presenting them as graphic novel memoirs.
An awkward phrasing.
Yeah, it didn't quite sit right with me because is it a novel or is it a memoir? And I think they're memoirs. These are real stories. You know, Cece Bell lost her hearing as a child, and but it's wonderful to do this visually too. Her characters are rabbits, so they have these enormous ears, which really. It's witty and almost kind of moving, too. You see the importance of ears that we can
right.
kind of overlook.
And this is the third memoir from Raina Telgemeier, who became such a star with her book Smile, about getting braces.
And this one is about a road trip that a family takes. It's called Sisters, and the two sisters fight and then reconcile. And it was nice that my predecessor, Sarah Smith, had assigned it to Maya Van Wagenen, who is herself a young writer. She's a junior in high school, wrote a book called Popular that was very well received and an interesting kind of year-long experiment where she tried to live by an old-fashioned etiquette book. And she's just a really nice writer. And it's nice to see a young person reading these books and being able to write so eloquently.
There's another interesting way of approaching the memoir in a book reviewed this week, written by Jacqueline Woodson.
It's called Brown Girl Dreaming, and it's a memoir in verse, which is another nice, it's always nice to see young children or younger people reading poetry and embracing poetry. And this is a verse about, you know, coming of age and facing all the challenges that adolescents face, and friendship and family problems and finding your own voice. And really nice, and a nice review by Veronica Chambers.
Another trend we've seen in recent years, and it shows no sign of abating, is writers who have sort of flourished in the grown-up world are turning to young adult literature.
Right. And in this issue, we have Andrea Portis, Anatomy of a Misfit. And she, her adult novels called Hick and Bury This did really well. They're sort of visceral and voicey. But with a YA novel, you can be even more voicey, I think. She shows here, and you know, there's a shocking ending. There's the usual social uncomfortableness and dynamics. There's a narrator with that really intimate, compelling voice that you get in a lot of these YA books that cross over.
Before we end, let's just take a minute to talk about if there were any books here that particularly appeal to you. I can talk about a couple of my favorites, but which ones did you particularly like?
Well, everything is, my life is very complicated right now. I'm settling into the new job in a new city. So I was really gravitating to the picture books. And I really loved, on the back to school theme, the Peter Brown, My Teacher is a Monster. Really adorable.
No, I'm not. Right?
My Teacher is a Monster. No, I'm not. Right. And it's one of those scenarios that does happen in life and can be life-changing. He really captured a kid who hates his teacher, and she's so mean, and she's drawn as almost like a giant rhinoceros who breathes fire, runs into her one day at the park, and it turns out she's not quite as much of a monster as he had thought. And it's funny and adorable, and it makes you think about all those times you've seen your teachers outside of the classroom.
It's funny because I was also going to talk about a picture book or two. I think that one of the things that's so great about the picture book genre that I think we all know but don't always bear in mind is that while we're reading them aloud to a child, the child is reading the pictures. Mm-hmm. And so you have two simultaneous narratives. And there are so many different ways an illustrator can work off another author, or an author-illustrator can create a story in conjunction with the written subplots word.
Even that are never represented in the words. It's
right.
Fantastic.
So one of the books this week in a little roundup of books about dogs is called Dog Versus Cat by Chris Gall, who wrote and illustrated it. And it's one of those books that, it's not aesthetically beautiful, but it's the drawings are intricate and humorous and rich. And as you're reading it, you know, the child beside you will often, beg you not to turn the pages.
Mm-hmm,
even if you finish the text, there's more to see. There's a whole story in there in a dog and a cat forced to share living quarters. And in the end, they confront a third unwanted member of the household, a new baby. Obviously a parable that many children can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Marie and I are both fans of picture books that can actually make grown-ups laugh or cry, and we both do. So welcome again to The Book Review.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And that was Maria Russo, the new children's books editor at The Book Review. Jen Salai joins me now to talk about this week's bestsellers. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
We only have four new entries on the hardcover fiction list. At 13, it's Fool's Assassin by Robin Hobb, which is the first installment of a new fantasy trilogy called Fitz and the Fool. And Hobb introduced us to Fitz Chivalry Farseer and his friend the Fool almost 20 years ago in one of her earlier books. At number three, we have The Sixth Extinction by James Rollins. It's his 10th Sigma Force novel. And Rollins, who is a veterinarian, describes the Sigma Force in an interview. He described them as scientists with guns. And so they arrive to find everything in a 50-mile radius of a military station totally dead, including the bacteria. And so they investigate what happened.
And he's a veterinarian?
He is a veterinarian. Apparently, he started phasing out his practice now that he's more of a novelist. But he's very interested in science.
That's an interesting hyphenate. And not a clear line between what he's writing about and what his medical practice.
Right. And entering at number two, we have Love Letters by Debbie Macomber. This is the third in her Rose Harbor series, and this is all about intimacy and secrets.
Something very different at number one.
And something very, very different at number one is Colorless: Tsukuru Tsuzaki and His Years of Pilgrimage by Haruki Murakami, who, of course, the book was reviewed on the cover of The Book Review a couple weeks ago by Patti Smith. And this is a story of a young man who reexamines his past and tries to reconnect with four high school friends who suddenly disappeared from his life when he was in college.
Well, this book, when it came out in Japan, sold a million copies in its first week. I don't know if we can quite compete with that, but clearly off to a strong start.
Indeed.
And nothing new on the nonfiction list?
Nothing new at all this week.
All right. Still at the top, America by Dinesh D'Souza.
Yes.
We will leave it at that. Thanks so much, Jen.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.